The Church of God, the Eternal, presents the 11th message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled A Survey of the Books of Samuel, given in Eugene, Oregon, July 26th, 2025.
Well, we're going to carry forward this week in our series on Survey of the Books of Samuel. And we're doing pretty well as far as at least keeping pace with the amount of material I'd love to cover. If you remember at the very beginning of this, I think I mentioned to you that my main purpose for wanting to cover these books was because I really want to cover the life of David. And now we're into sermon number 11, haven't even touched King David yet. But that is because the buildup toward the life of David and then his experiences and the meaning that that has for all of us includes the background story which begins at the very beginning of 1 Samuel, which is why we've covered it all. We're in the middle now of the beginning of the rule of King Saul. And of course, Saul is going to be a pivotal figure in the life of David. I mean, he was certainly involved in many of the trials and the difficulties that David experienced, as we're going to find out as we get into these later chapters. But last time in particular, you remember we completed chapter 10 of 1 Samuel, and we went through the story of God's public display of his selection of Saul to be king by use of a lottery system or the casting of lots and however it was done, so that God literally miraculously made it all come out to pick Saul, so that the people all gathered together in one place rather than just taking Samuel's word for it that God had picked him and he had already anointed him, if you'll remember. And yet we saw now God created a public display to confirm the fact that this one particular man out of all of the thousands was the one that that had God's blessing for this new office. We also saw that Samuel takes the opportunity to repeat the fact that in asking for a human king, Israel literally had slapped God in the face, figuratively, by even asking it. And he's not going to be over, because when we get into chapter 12, Samuel's going to say it again. So he said it in chapter 8, he repeated it in chapter 10, he's going to say it again in chapter 12. So actually, if we'll get through 11, and we see it, this is a repeated theme which makes it very, very important in how we view all of these events that took place. Remember, at the end of it, the entire nation said, God save the king, even though there were ones who doubted and did not accept Saul at all. And we went through kind of the factors that are always involved in that. So we're going to begin in chapter 11 now, and to see the first big test for the new King Saul, which is a threat from an exterior nation and an army now, which is going to threaten them in their borderlands. So beginning in verse 1 of 1 Samuel 11, we read, "Then Nahash the Ammonite came up and encamped against Jabesh Gilead. And all the men of Jabesh said unto Nahash, make a covenant with us and we will serve thee." All right, who is this Nahash? Where is this town Jabesh Gilead? And what are the factors that are involved? First, we're dealing with a general, a king called an Ammonite. Well, where was the Ammonite territory located? Geographically, we're talking about the east side of the Jordan River. So if you look at a map of Israel, and basically with the Jordan River on mostly the eastern border, but not really, because remember there were two particular tribes back when the land was first divided up, when Israel was allowed to go into the promised land and take over their new property under the leadership of Joshua. Remember, there were two tribes that particularly asked permission in order to make their homeland on the east side of the Jordan River rather than on the other side where most of those tribes would then settle. That you can read that story yourself in Numbers 32 and in Joshua 13. So it was two tribes, in particular Gad and Reuben, were the ones. And the historians say it's because they were especially known for their livestock and their herds, and there was a lot of really fine grazing land on the east side of the Jordan River. So as they passed through that land on their way to the Jordan River to cross over, they really liked that land and wanted that to be their land. So God gave approval for that. They were able to stay there as long with the provision that they couldn't just stop and camp and say bye to everybody else. They needed to cross the Jordan River and help the rest of the tribes actually take possession of their inheritance, meaning against the enemies of the Canaanites who were there. So, but in the final analysis then, all of the families of those two tribes of Gad and of Reuben then made their settlements on the east side of the river. This is where this battle now was going to take place. Well, where were these Ammonites? Well, if Gad and Reuben were right adjoining the Jordan River, the Ammonites were now further east of Gad and Reuben. So you had the Ammonites in the desert areas out to the east. You had the Moabites now to the south. All right, so just give you, if some of you have maps in the back of your Bibles, then you can get a picture. I like the maps. I like to actually see things. But it's worth looking up if you're interested in it. So this Ammonite territory was located, bordered the tribes of Gad and Reuben. So what about this town of Jabesh-Gilead? Well, this was a major capital city, if you will, in the tribe of Gad. That's where this is taking place. So really what is happening is the Ammonites under King Nahash now are making an incursion into Gad. And now with their army, they're threatening, and they're basically, they're going to try to take over all of this property, all of this territory. Who were the Ammonites? Where did the Ammonites come from? And it goes for the answer to the question about the Moabites as well. Go all the way back to Genesis 19. I'm not going to read the story, but you remember what happened after God saved Lot and his family out of Sodom? And remember, the angel came and literally brought them out before God destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. And remember, the wife of Lot, because she pined for the things in Sodom, God turned her into a pillar of salt. Okay, well then after this, okay, Lot and his youngest daughters were the ones who then escaped. And then they lived in a cave for a period of time. And what happened there? All right, these daughters then decided, well, there weren't any eligible men for them, so they were going to actually get their father drunk and then get pregnant by their father so that they could have children. What a great idea. And that's exactly what they did. So jumping in the middle of that, in Genesis 19, verse 35, the tail end of this story, just to pick you up, to tell you who the Ammonites were and who the Moabites were. And they, meaning the daughters of Lot, made their father drink wine that night also. This was the second one in a row, by the way. And the younger arose and lay with him, and he perceived not when she lay down nor when she arose. Thus were both the daughters of Lot with child by their father. And the firstborn, verse 37, bare a son and called his name Moab, the same as the father of the Moabites unto this day. Verse 38, and the younger, she also bare a son and called his name Ben-Ammi, the same as the father of the children of Ammon unto this day. So who were the Moabites and who were the Ammonites? They were descendants of Lot and thereby of Abraham, because remember, Abraham was the uncle of Lot. So they're all part of a big extended family, if you will. These two, of course, by incest. All right. Now, where were they as far as God's view? Well, Deuteronomy 23, verse 3 and 4. And by the way, the name Ben-Ammi, scholars want to debate on what its literal translation is. But the best one I know of is son of my kin, which almost gives him a name which harkens back to the incest by which he was produced. Son of my kin. Okay, so that's the Ammonites. Deuteronomy 23, verse 3 and 4 tells you how God viewed now all of the families, because both of these boys grew up and then became heads of their own dynasties, if you will, or their own family or own nations. All right? Deuteronomy 23, verse 3, the Ammonite or the Moabite, God says, shall not enter into the congregation of the Eternal. Why? Because they were born out of incest? No. Because if God were going to use that rule, there were a whole lot of others that couldn't be there either, like the descendants of Judah. Because in fact, the entire Jewish nation, meaning those who came out of the tribe of Judah, came out of incest as well. That's a whole different story. So God is very forgiving. Thank God for that. But there was another reason that the Ammonites and the Moabites were confirmed as enemies of Israel, and in God's view then became untouchable, if you will. And here we find it. The Ammonite and the Moabite shall not enter into the congregation of the Eternal. Even to their 10th generation shall they not enter into the congregation of the Eternal forever. That's pretty stern. Why? Verse 4, because, here's the answer, they met you not with bread and water in the way when you came forth out of Egypt. Meaning when Israel was brought out of Egypt by God and made a nation, and they were passing through the lands dominated by the Moabites and the Ammonites on their way to the promised land. Rather than the Moabites and the Ammonites treating the Israelite families with kindness, they treated them as enemies and refused to help them in any way. So it was their own actions toward God's chosen people that caused them to be enemies. And so God said, for that reason, Israelites, if you want God's favor, never ever take a Moabite or an Ammonite into your family by marriage or any other means. Because they met you not with bread and with water in the way when you came forth out of Egypt. And here's the second part. They hired against thee Balaam, the son of Beor of Pethor of Mesopotamia, to curse thee. So that whole story about Balaam also involved these same peoples. So here you've got now a nation of Ammon and the nation of Moab are on the borders on the east and the south, the outer reaches now of this land, that the homeland of the Israelites. Now, who is the only, or one of the only exceptions now to this prohibition of God? Ruth. A whole book of the Bible just about her and her story. Because she was a Moabitess. And yet, she was allowed and given God's sanction, approval, to actually marry into the Israelites. And in fact, Ruth then became one of the matriarchs of the lineage of Jesus Christ, which is interesting in itself, is it not? Further emphasizing the fact that what God is really interested in is about the individual character. It's not about our ancestry physically, our genealogy. It's about our behavior. So by having exceptions like that, including not only Ruth, but Rahab the harlot, who was a Canaanite, absolutely forbidden by God for the Israelites to take wives of the Canaanites, and yet he made an example or an exception to that rule for Rahab because of her behavior to show love and respect and fear for the one true God and to embrace that way. Well, Ruth did the same thing, which is why they were treated truly as an exception. But for the most part, these people were the enemies of Israel and continued to be that way. It wasn't just Ammonites and Moabites. Who were the other major enemies to Israel? And I would tell you on the world scene today, it is still there. Was it not the descendants of Esau and of Ishmael? Yes. And what do they all have in common? They're all family related. They're all family related because they all came out in one way or another as a descendant of Abraham. And so the greatest enemies to Israel were actually their relatives. And that animosity exists today. If you want to understand a lot of what's going on in the world scene today in modern times, if you think this Bible stuff is outdated and it doesn't apply anymore, yeah, it still does, because it still defines a lot of the animosities and the borderlines between enemies that are still present today Now, we can't confirm exactly who these people are, and there was a lot of speculation in our parent organization about who, like that, you know, the descendants of Esau are in current and modern day Turkey, you know, and who the Moabites were and who the Ammonites are. But they're all over there. They're still over there mixed up in the Middle East. But I guarantee you that there's a reason that they are still absolutely the enemies of anyone who is a true Israelite today. All right. Back to 1 Samuel. Before we go back to 1 Samuel 11, I'm going to go to 1 Samuel 12, verse 12 and 13. And the reason I'm going forward is because there's a statement here. We're talking about this attack now of this Ammonite king named Nahash. Well, Samuel makes a reference to it in the next chapter. And if we get that far, we're going to read it, but I want to lift this out so you have a context as we read chapter 11. 1 Samuel 12, verse 12. Samuel is reciting another brief history of the whole travels and the exploits of the Israelites with God's help. And here in verse 12 of 1 Samuel 12, Samuel says, "And when you saw that Nahash, the king of the children of Ammon, came against you, you said unto me, Nay, but a king shall reign over us, when the Lord your God was your king." What? Where did this come from? We didn't see that way back in chapter 8. 1 Samuel 8, where we saw the story of Israel, the Israelites asking Samuel for a human king. We didn't see the name Nahash or anything about Ammon, but both must be true. So in chapter 8, what was their reason for asking for a king? It's because Samuel was old and his sons were untrustworthy. His adult sons did not have Samuel's character, and they were afraid for the future, and that's why they asked for a king. But here, is this a contradiction? Because here Samuel says in verse 12, "When you saw that Nahash, the king of the children of Ammon, came against you, you said to me, Nay, but a king shall reign over us, when the Lord your God was your king." Well, both statements must be true. So the reality is there were multiple factors that were at play at the time that the Israelites gathered together and demanded of Samuel that they wanted a human king. Yes, it was worried. It had to be a worry then that the sons of Samuel were not up to the task. They didn't have the character for it. But at the very same time, there was already this threat by this enemy kingdom to the east, on the east side of the Jordan River. So this is where we find out that this king of the Ammonites, Nahash, was already in the minds of the Israelites. They were afraid. They already knew it was an impending conflict that was coming. Now, up to now, we've only seen Israel's interaction with and battles with the Philistines on the west. Now, all of a sudden, we've got another enemy on their eastern border. So, but it was already true. So if you go back and reread chapter 8 with this little piece of information, it actually fills out another element of the story. So multiple reasons that the Israelites demanded a king, because they were afraid. It wasn't just they were worried about the future. That was one element of their fear. And they didn't think Samuel's sons were up to the task, and they were right. But it was because there was an impending threat already of an enemy nation. So all of those factors put together caused them to demand a solution. And their solution, according to their human wisdom, was that they needed a king. They needed a champion who could lead them and help them as a general against their enemies, let alone to be a judge or, you know, a magistrate who could wisely rule within the nation itself. So now let's go back to chapter 11. Read it again, verse 1. "And Nahash the Ammonite came up and encamped against Jabesh Gilead." So this major city of the Israelites on the east side of the Jordan River. Now, where was Jabesh Gilead? I try and look this up, and the scholars aren't exactly sure of this. Jabesh Gilead was approximately 20 to 30 miles west of the capital city of the Ammonites. It was probably then 8 to 15 miles from the Jordan River to the west. So from the Jordan River, you go 8 to 15 miles, and you get this city, which was on this river. And then you go another 20 to 30 miles to the east, and now you're in the territory of the Ammonites. And their capital city, which was on the same river. All right. Now, verse 2, Nahash the Ammonite answered them. So the people, the Israelites of Jabesh-Gilead, they don't have any way to defend themselves, this Ammonite king, and it doesn't tell us how many he brought with him in an army, but it was substantial enough that they said, you know, we are helpless, we are not going to fight you, just make a treaty with us. And Nahash the Ammonite answered them, on this condition will I make a covenant with you, that I may thrust out all your right eyes and lay it for a reproach upon all Israel. Now, why would he want to do this? Was there a practical reason other than just being cruel and vindictive? It was too humble because he was moving in and wanted to take over this entire territory. Now, what was the practical reason to putting out the right eyes of all the people? I think the scholars may be onto something here, because when you're talking about warriors, when you're talking about the potential of these people to resist in battle, putting out the right eye, with the right eye gone, a warrior's ability to scan to the right and the central battlefield is compromised. Remember, most of these people were right-handed as well, which means they held a sword in a right hand and they held a shield in the left. So if you don't have a right eye, one, you can't see even to use your sword well, and your left eye, which you still have, is partially blocked either by a helmet and or the shield. So it was a clever way not to totally make these people, disabled so that they can't work and they can't take care of themselves, but it absolutely impedes them from being warriors. So absolutely fascinating and clever to say, I'm coming in with my army, I'm taking over, and in order for me not to kill you, my requirement is I'm going to put out the right eye of all of you. It would have made them vassals without a practical way to defend themselves or to rebel in a later time to create an uprising. Absolutely clever. Verse 3, and the elders of Jabesh said unto him, give us 7 days respite, that we may send messengers unto all the coast of Israel, and then if there be no man to save us, we will come out to thee. Very interesting. Nahash should have just said, nope, make your decision now. His first mistake was he allowed them, he gave them 7 days. In essence, Nahash must have been very, very confident, because they said the reason we want 7 days to make our decision is because we want to ask all of our other Israelite brothers across the Jordan River if they will come and save us from you. Nahash must have been confident that he could defeat whoever might come if anybody came. And so literally he gave them approval for a 1 week respite for them to send their messengers to see if anybody would come and actually array themselves against the Ammonite horde. Now, it doesn't tell us how many were in his army. It must have been a substantial number, however. Verse 4, then came the messengers to Gibeah of Saul, meaning across the Jordan River in the particular tribal lands of Benjamin, which is where Saul was and where his headquarters was now in the city of Gibeah. And these messengers come across and told the tidings in the ears of the people, and all the people lifted up their voices and wept. So now we're going to see the very first test of the new king, Saul. So verse 5 now, and behold, Saul came after the herd out of the field. What was the king of Israel doing? He was out with his flocks in the field, which means this ceremonial acceptance of him as a king, but they didn't really do much immediately after that. And they all kind of went back home again. Saul went back to his home. He's out kind of doing the things he was doing before. Saul came after the herd out of the field, and Saul said, "What ails the people that they weep?" He saw the reaction of the people who already heard the news before him. They told him the tidings of the men of Jabesh. So how did Saul react? The Spirit of God came upon Saul when he heard those tidings, and his anger was kindled greatly. So he responded with indignation against this attack of the Ammonites in the east. So this is your first sense of what kind of a character did Saul have. He was humble, which is a good thing. But did he have the spine? Did he have the ability to be a strong king, to lead in times of threat and difficulty? And now you're finding that his reaction, whereas the people by and large were afraid of this threat of the Ammonites, Saul responds with indignation. It also tells us that he was being motivated and led and influenced by God in his response. The Spirit of God came upon Saul when he heard those tidings, and his anger was kindled greatly. And so what does Saul do? Okay, well, basically Saul is going to call up the militia, if you will. In essence, he's going to call up all of the able-bodied men of Israel throughout the entire nation to form an army and to go confront the Ammonites. So how's he going to do this? Well, he could have just sent messengers and said, "Hey, remember me? I'm your new king. We got a job. We got an enemy on our eastern flank. All y'all need to come over here." Well, to punctuate it, and Saul, knowing he was new and he was unproven, and we've already seen that there were all of this whole contingent, we don't know what percentage of them that did not trust him, that did not really accept Saul as their king. At the end of chapter 10, they were called the children of Belial, weren't they? So he had no confidence whatsoever that he had true support. So what does he do? He took a yoke of oxen, verse 7, and hewed them in pieces. So I'm assuming this is two oxen that would have been, part of this farming enterprise with a plow or a wagon, and sent them throughout all the coast of Israel by the hands of messengers, saying. So he sent messengers to every tribe in every area with pieces of this livestock. Sent them throughout the coast of Israel by the hands of messengers, saying, "Whosoever cometh not forth after Saul and after Samuel, so shall it be done unto his oxen." So Saul sends a request with a threat. He says, "This is serious. You all need to play your part. You need to come help us to defeat this enemy. And if you don't, you will pay a price." Now, maybe it was an empty threat. Maybe Saul didn't have the capacity to follow through on it. But notice, Saul didn't just use his own name. He employed the name of Samuel too, didn't he? There was your power. There was your respect behind the throne, if you will, because of Samuel for so many years, who had been the respected judge and a prophet in the nation. So Saul wisely employs the name of Samuel, not just his own. "Whosoever cometh not forth after Saul and after Samuel," after both of us, "so shall it be done unto his oxen." How did the people react? "And the fear of the Eternal fell on the people." Does this mean God also motivated the minds of the people like he had with Saul? Or does this imply more so that they had a natural carnal human respect and a fear for the fact that Saul and Samuel were together on this, and they believed that God was backing them up? Was it the fact that they believed they didn't want to go against God, and God was backing Saul and Samuel, so in fear for that? Or was it that God gave them a special inspiration? Maybe one, maybe the other, maybe both. "Nevertheless, the fear of the Eternal fell on the people, and they came out with one consent." They rallied to the call. Verse 8, "And when he numbered them in Bezek," all right, where was Bezek? All right, Bezek was another city on the eastern side of the Jordan River. So he didn't assemble the army in the major, you know, the tribal lands west. He literally had this marshaling point on the other side of the Jordan River. Where? In relationship to Jabesh-Gilead. Actually to the north. So this city of Bezek was further to the north. Now what was above the tribe of Gad? You had Gad, and then you had Reuben to the south, and then you had Moabite. You had the Ammonites to the east. Who was above Gad? A half tribe of Manasseh. So you can go back and look at the history then of how all those tribal lands were divvied up. But ultimately, the tribe of Manasseh had two portions, one on the west side of the Jordan River, as well as this huge tribal tract on the east side of the Jordan to the north. So the Gad, the border between Gad and Manasseh now was a significant division. This city of Bezek, scholars don't know for certain, but it was either in very northern Gad or else in southern Manasseh. It was somewhere in that borderline between the properties of the two tribes. This city's selection as a muster point suggests that it was a significant or accessible location. Remember, he's calling up the armies from all the tribes in the entire nation. All right? So rather than all of them having to cross the Jordan River, very likely they all came around the Sea of Galilee to the north and then were able to descend in. Don't know that for certain. But however, within quick order, they were able to assemble this army. It was possibly in a plain or a plateau suitable for assembling a large army, and it was within a day's march of Jabesh-Gilead, which is going to be the site of the battle. So he picked a place, Saul picked a place that would get them all as easily as possible into one place and near the site of the eventual battle with Nahash and the Ammonites. But it was out of sight, and as we're going to see, what's implied is that it was a secret assembly. And there was an element of surprise that took place here. The scholars think that this city of Bezek was maybe 20 to 30 miles north of Jabesh-Gilead. Okay? So if that's where their rallying point is, it means they've got about a day's march in order to get to the site of the battle. Verse 9, and they said unto the messengers that came, thus shall you say unto the men of Jabesh-Gilead, tomorrow, by that time the sun be hot, you shall have help. So they sent these messengers who had first come to ask Saul for the help. They sent them back to the peoples of Jabesh-Gilead with an answer and said, we're coming. And we'll be there by noon the next day. So the messengers have time to get 20, 30 miles back to Jabesh-Gilead to pass along the answer and to say by noon tomorrow, the army of Israel is coming to confront the Ammonites. You shall have help. And the messengers came and showed it to the men of Jabesh, and they were glad. Verse 10, therefore the men of Jabesh said to Nahash. So now they have to answer, and it doesn't tell us how many days elapsed. Was it the entire 7 days? Were we right at the threshold of the end of the week? Maybe, perhaps. Wouldn't be surprised. How long would it take to muster, one, to send out the messengers to all the tribes, and then to have them respond, and then to gather them all together? Not even counting the Sabbath in between, it probably took the full time. And so then now what did Jabesh tell them, the people of Jabesh? The men of Jabesh said, in essence, to Nahash, they answered him who's waiting for a reply, tomorrow we will come out unto you, and you shall do with us that seemeth good to you. Oh, they didn't say the Israel army is here. They said, in essence, they implied, we sent out our messengers, nobody's coming to help us, so tomorrow we're going to submit ourselves to you and your will, including to pull out our right eyes. In essence, they used subterfuge so that Nahash was expecting a capitulation, a surrender. And I wouldn't be surprised if the 7-day mark was up that next day. And so now they're saying, okay, we give up. Tomorrow we'll come out and we'll surrender to you. Verse 11, and it was on the morrow that Saul put the people in three companies. And this is a very classic array for ancient armies, basically with a center column, and then you've got a left wing and a right wing with different functions, and if you've got cavalry involved in it or whatever. So you see through the ancient world a lot of this arrays in three companies when you've got a very large army. What was the size of this army? Saul put the people in three companies, and they came into the midst of the host in the morning watch. I think I had missed the part that said that there was 330,000 of these Israelites. Anyway, so Israel comes with a very large army. When did they come? In the morning watch. When was that? At this time in history, basically they divided time the night watch into three divisions, beginning at sunset and ending at sunrise. The first watch was from sunset to 10 p.m. The middle watch was from 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. And the morning watch then began at 2 a.m. and ended at sunrise. So if they come up in the morning watch and slew the Ammonites until the heat of the day, when did they arrive? They arrived before 6 a.m. So Saul had told the men of Jabesh that they would be there by noon the next day. But when did they actually arrive with the full army? Before 6 a.m. If it were 20 or 30 miles away to the north, that meant they were basically, that army was probably marching through the night in order to get there. And then they had a surprise for the entire Ammonite army when they arrived at sunrise. Okay, so even the men of Jabesh Gilead did not even know. It was a surprise to them when they showed up and slew the Ammonites into the heat of the day. How long did the battle go on? At least 6 hours. Or at least, very likely, a minimum. And it came to pass, they which remained were scattered so that the two of them were not left together. You're talking about a total annihilation. Again, I wish that God had chosen to reveal the number of the army of the Ammonites, and he didn't do it. So we don't know how large this army was, but it was an Israelite slaughter of Nahash and his men. This then cemented the first great victory of Saul and set his reputation not just as a king who had been, dubbed by Samuel or even by God, but now the people saw that he had the mettle that was required to be a warrior king to defend them. And after this, now we find that he did indeed win over the majority of the hearts of the Israelites at this particular time. Verse 12, the people said unto Samuel, "Who is he that said, shall Saul reign over us? Bring the men that we may put them to death." So the first thing that a lot of people have in mind is, who were these ones who refused to accept Saul? The ones, remember, in verse 27 of chapter 10, called the children of Belial, who said, "This man will not reign over us." So it obviously was publicized enough that a lot of people knew it. And so now the ones who initially had supported Saul, had backed him because of this great victory, now they want vindication against the ones who doubted and were late to the party. Isn't that a natural human reaction? We won. Now we want retribution against these ones that didn't side with us from the beginning. Verse 13, and Saul said, "There shall not a man be put to death this day. For today the Eternal hath wrought salvation in Israel." See, Saul was giving credit to God. He was showing wisdom. He was showing restraint. But he was showing the absolute spine to be able to act without fear and to go forward and do what is necessary. Those are all the great attributes of a leader. Saul had the package. And now he's pushing back against this contingent of his own people who now want to turn this into a retribution against these ones who didn't initially accept Saul. And Saul says, no, we're not going to do that. We're not looking for retribution. So Saul's wise act was an attempt to convert the holdouts to his side rather than, you know, look for heads on a stake. He wanted to convince them and bring them over into his camp. Even if they doubted him early on and said, we're not going to follow him. Now, here's an opportunity to actually bring more into his support. Don't make enemies out of them when you can make friends out of them. Absolutely wise. And Saul showed his determination not to foster civil strife within the nation. An absolutely wise act. Verse 14, then said Samuel to the people, come and let us go to Gilgal, on the west side of which is on the west side of the Jordan River, just inside the territory of Benjamin. This was, remember that city we saw a couple of chapters ago, where Samuel had told Saul to come and to meet him. So here's the same city. Samuel said to the people, come and let us go to renew the kingdom there. And all the people went to Gilgal, another massive national meeting of all the people now, just on the west side of the Jordan River. And there they made Saul king before the Eternal in Gilgal. Wait a minute, how many times are they going to make Saul king? God already anointed him by Samuel. We had the lottery where God said, this is my guy. Here's a miracle to prove it. But after this battle, now I would tell you that this is the closest thing that we have as a national gathering and an actual coronation. It gives us no details of what they did, but this was the time literally when the entire nation supported the choice of Saul. And then in this national gathering of all the people together, there they made Saul king before the Eternal in Gilgal. In the last meeting, God pointed out who his anointed was. But this time, the people are showing that to God their acceptance of the one that he picked. And there they sacrificed sacrifices of peace offerings before the Eternal, and there Saul and all the men of Israel rejoiced greatly. Even though Samuel had already anointed Saul, this is the confirmation now, which goes to make the point. It's one thing to give somebody an office. It's another thing to have them grow into it and to earn it. And so Samuel is not going to miss the opportunity to give a speech while he's got everybody together. And now we get into chapter 12. For this coronation celebration, this victory celebration against the Ammonites. Chapter 12, verse 1, Samuel said to all Israel, behold, I have hearkened unto your voice and all that you said unto me and have made a king over you. And now he says, behold, the king walks before you and I am old and gray headed. And behold, my sons are with you. The sons that nobody respected because they were selfish and greedy, did not have the character necessary to lead the nation, but they were there. Samuel says, and I have walked before you from my childhood unto this day. Hearken back to the beginning of this book. And we saw little Samuel, probably at 3 or 4, when he was first turned over to Eli the high priest and was raised in that household, helping the priest with those duties of the tabernacle. And now in his old age, Samuel says, behold, here I am. Witness against me before the Eternal and before his anointed. So Samuel's doing something very provocative here. He's giving this speech to the whole nation and he's going to make them answer the question publicly. Was I a good judge or not? He's going to force them to acknowledge whether he had conducted his duties as judge with equity. Now, well, just let the record, you know, write itself. Surely everybody knew, right? He had a reputation. Why make this pointed requirement for them to actually say the words and nod their heads. Because if you don't, carnal human beings will rewrite history. That's what happens. It doesn't matter what the facts are. Somebody, for political reasons in the future, will try to rewrite what happened in the past and put a different slant on it for their own selfish ends. Samuel is forcing them to declare as a nation together with unanimity the history of how Samuel did his job for what, 50, 60 years at this point? He's up over 70 years old at this point. Now, he's got to last for a little longer, as we're going to find out, and I made reference to this a few sermons ago. We know that Saul reigned for 40 years. So this is the very beginning of his 40 years. Samuel's going to live into the middle, or even past the halfway point. He's going to live for another 20 plus years. He's old. I mean, he's already been called old. He's called himself old and gray-headed. But he's going to live at least 80, maybe 90. So he's old now, but he's still got a lot of history in the storyline. Now behold, the king walks before you, and I am old and gray-headed. And behold, my sons are with you, and I have walked before you from my childhood unto this day. Behold, here am I, witness against me before the Eternal and before his anointed. And now he asks the questions. Whose ox have I taken? Whose ox have I taken, or whose ass have I taken? Or whom have I defrauded? Whom have I oppressed? Or of what, or of whose hand have I received any bribe to blind mine eyes therewith? And I will restore it to you. If anybody, he's saying, can come up with any example over all of these decades where I have taken personal advantage of any of you, declare it now, and I will restore it. Verse 4, and they said, thou hast not defrauded us, nor oppressed us, neither hast thou taken aught of any man's hand. He literally got them to say it out loud. And he said unto them in reply, the Eternal is witness against you, and his anointed is witness this day, meaning Saul the king. In essence, he says, you have said it out loud in front of God and King Saul, that I have never betrayed you, I've never taken advantage of you, selfishly used you, or defrauded you in any way over all of my years of leadership in this nation. That you have not found aught in my hand, meaning you don't find any greedy lucre that I ever stole from you or took. I never abused my office to make myself rich. And you've just said it, you've confirmed it before God and King Saul. And they answered, he is witness. So in essence, they made a declaration, a statement, a fact before God to confirm the fact that Samuel had lived his life as a faithful servant to the nation of Israel. That's pretty cool. It's pretty phenomenal. What happens next? Next, Samuel repeats the history of God's dealing with the nation of Israel. He never misses an opportunity. So, beginning in verse 6, Samuel said unto the people, it is the Eternal that advanced Moses and Aaron and that brought your fathers up out of the land of Egypt. He's going to go all the way back and tell them how they got to where they are that day. Verse 7, now therefore stand still that I may reason with you before the Eternal of all the righteous acts of the Eternal which he did to you and of your fathers. When Jacob was come into Egypt, your fathers cried unto the Eternal. Then the Eternal sent Moses and Aaron, which brought forth your fathers out of Egypt, and made them dwell in this place. And when they forgot the Eternal their God, because they did, and they always did, sooner or later, he sold them into the hand of Sisera, captain of the host of Hazor. That you'll find in Judges chapter 4 and 5. We're not going to turn to it or rehearse it, but that story's in the book of Judges. And into the hand of the Philistines. You can find that in Judges chapter 13 through 16. And into the hand of the king of Moab. You can find that in Judges 3 verses 12 through 30. and they fought against them. Verse 10, and they cried unto the Eternal and said, we have sinned because we have forsaken the Eternal and have served Balaam and Ashtaroth. But now deliver us out of the hand of our enemies, and we will serve thee. And the Eternal sent Jerubbabel and Bedan and Jephthah and Samuel. So he includes himself in the end of the list of the servants that God raised up and used in a powerful way in order to help and deliver Israel. And delivered you out of the hand of your enemies on every side, and you dwelled safe. And now this is the verse that I read to you in advance. We'll read it again. And when you saw that Nahash, the king of the children of Ammon, came against you, you said unto me, nay, but a king shall reign over us. And when the Eternal your God, was your king. Now therefore, behold, the king whom you have chosen and whom you have desired, and behold, the Eternal has set a king over you. So he encapsulates that whole history of Israel from coming out of Egypt with a high hand. All of their rebellions, generation after generation, God's mercy and forbearance, then to bring them back out of captivity and oppression by their enemies through the champions, which you see throughout the book of Judges, culminating now into where they were with this, the aftermath of this great victory against the Ammonite horde. And why is Samuel doing this? He's trying to impress upon the people. History repeats itself, to try and encourage them to finally stop making the mistakes of their ancestors, which was to depart from God, to turn to idolatry, and then only after God allowed them to be taken over by their enemies, usually for approximate period of 40 years, then God would raise up a champion to miraculously deliver them and make them independent again. The problem was, they could never pass on those lessons to their children and grandchildren because every generation thought they knew better. So within about another 40 years, what would happen? The next generation did exactly what their parents and grandparents did. And they would turn likewise to Sabbath breaking and idolatry. Displease God, God would retract from them, allow their enemies to take them over and persecute them for decades. And then eventually, when their hearts were softened, when they got a belly full of the curses that came from their rebellion, then God would raise someone up and bring them back out. And then that generation would be blessed. Usually no more than 40 years. And then the cycle would happen all over again. And that's exactly what their history showed. So Samuel's impressing upon them this short history and saying, you don't have to go through this. Your children don't have to go through this if you will learn the lessons of the past. Samuel now prophesies of the consequences for obedience on one hand or else rebellion on the other. Verse 14, if you will fear the Eternal, and serve him and obey his voice and not rebel against the commandment of the Eternal, then shall both you and also the king that reigns over you continue following the Lord your God. Now, I find it very interesting here. Very easy to read over this, but what did Samuel say by God's inspiration? He's talking to the people. He's saying, if ye will learn this lesson and obey, what will happen if you, the people, from the grassroots, as Mr. Raymond Cole, a grassroots movement of obedience, what would be the result? Then shall both you and also the king that reigns over you to continue follow the Lord. Isn't that interesting? If the people would obey, he said, then your king will obey. You and your king will follow God. But it seemed to happen opposite in the actual history. What actually happened in the ensuing history? When we get into the life of David and then Solomon and then a division of the kingdom under Rehoboam and Jeroboam and all of the kings of Israel and Judah, the opposite happened. Every once in a while you would have a good king. Never in the northern kingdom of Israel and only every once in a while in the southern kingdom of Judah. And what did the people do? They always followed the example of their king. So most of the time you had bad kings and they were idolaters. And so the people, they did the same. And then if you had an unusual king who actually obeyed God, like a Hezekiah or a Josiah, they would bring the nation back to obedience. But it was through the will of one man who was in the leadership position and had God's backing in order to reform the nation. Do you think that was from the heart? No. Why was it never from the heart? Because as soon as that king died and another king came up who did not follow God, then the people reverted to their idolatry, just like before, which shows it was not in their mind and their heart. It wasn't sincere at all on the part of the people. So literally what Samuel is prophesying here, by the inspiration of God, if the people would be faithful to God, then they would get leadership. Likewise, that would be a blessing. That never happened in the history of Israel. It was, you know, that seemed like the tail wagging the dog rather than the dog wagging the tail. Because the reality was, if you had a good king, the people were blessed. But as soon as you had a bad king, the people were cursed. Because they didn't follow God. They were just following their human king, for better or for worse. But Samuel states it out here. If the people would obey God, they would be blessed and their leadership would be blessed. Do you think that principle would still apply today? Do you think if there was a nation of people, I don't care what race, or what geography on the globe, if there was a people who collectively, individually believed in the truth of God and practiced the truth of God, do you think God would bless them with leadership? Yeah. Because that's part of his promises. But it never happens in the kingdoms of men. Verse 15, but if you will not obey the voice of the Eternal, but rebel against the commandments of the Eternal, then shall the hand of the Eternal be against you as it was against your fathers. Samuel saying, if you act like your ancestors, you'll get the fruits of the results that your ancestors always got. Think you're smarter, think you're better, think you're more powerful, think you don't need to follow God, or else you can change how to worship the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob according to your own whims, not the way he told you to do it. Think you're smart enough and you will pay the price just like they always did. Verse 16, now therefore stand and see this great thing which the Eternal will do before your eyes. What great thing? God is getting ready to perform a miracle in their very sight. So Samuel just gave this speech. He just gave this prophecy concerning how they can be happy for generations to come, what the formula is for success. And now he's going to punctuate that with God's support by a miracle which is going to take place. Verse 17, is it not wheat harvest today? What does that have to do with anything? You're going to see. Is it not wheat harvest today? Samuel says, I will call unto the Eternal and he shall send thunder and rain that you may perceive and see that your wickedness is great, which you have done in the sight of the Eternal and asking you a king. Ah, there it is again. He can't resist. He's reminding him again that their initial request for a human king was an act of rebellion. As I call it, a slap in the face of God. And now he says it again. Which is just reminding them that they were a faithless people, which of course, faith is a fruit of God's Holy Spirit. What did we already learn? Why did they ask for a human king? Because they were afraid. They were afraid of an unknown future after Samuel was gone, and they were afraid of enemies on their border. And fear drives human beings to make mistakes. That's why they did it. You can understand it. I can understand it. It wasn't that I wanted to be rebellious. I wasn't trying to be disrespectful to God. But I was in this bad circumstance between a rock and a hard place, an enemy at the gate, and uncertain leadership. We needed an answer. We needed a solution. I wasn't trying to be bad. It wasn't my fault. It's always the way it is for human beings. But Samuel is setting the record straight and says, no, you didn't trust your God. You had a king and you didn't believe him and you didn't trust him. So you're going to solve your problem your own way. And that's always the thing that leads to the curses of God's people. That's why it's written here, as the Apostle Paul said in 1 Corinthians 10, these were examples for us upon whom the ends of the world are come. All this is there. It didn't benefit them. It's supposed to benefit you and me. If, by chance, we will learn from those examples so that we don't do the exact same thing when we're faced with fearful or threatening circumstances, but to learn to trust our God. Verse 18, so Samuel called unto the Eternal, and the Eternal sent thunder and rain in that day. Big deal. Thunderstorm. Why did that make an impression? Because in the land of the day, that this was a period of time. The commentators say this wheat harvest, it typically occurred in late spring, early to mid summer, probably anywhere from May to July. This period is known as the dry season. And in that Mediterranean climate was characterized by clear weather and little to no rainfall, which means rain during this particular time was rare and often seen as a disruption to the harvest, potentially even damaging the crops. So this is a period of time when they really didn't want the rain, and they didn't usually get the rain. So what's happening here is God is backing up Samuel with this miracle to have this huge thunderstorm out of season. Now, it doesn't say, did it damage the crops? Very likely. But in essence, Samuel gives them this speech, he gives them this prophecy, he gives them this warning, and then God punctuates it with the miracle of weather out of season, so that they would know this isn't just Samuel kind of talking off the top of his hat. This was the word of God through Samuel for their admonition. What was the result? Samuel called unto the Eternal, and the Eternal sent thunder and rain that day, and all the people greatly feared the Eternal and Samuel. So how did the people respond? They didn't say, big deal, a thunderstorm. No, it shook them to the core. They saw it as a miracle because this did not happen. Verse 19, and all the people said unto Samuel, pray for thy servants unto the Eternal thy God that we die not. I find it interesting that they call him Samuel's God. He didn't say our God. Another testament to the fact that the people acknowledged the existence of God, the power of God. They were seeing the manifestation of his power right there with this thunderstorm out of season. They were afraid of him, but they weren't close to him, and they certainly didn't love him. Pray for thy servants. This is what a lot of people do. They ask others who they perceive as being close to God to pray for them. Please pray for me, because you're the one close to God. He doesn't know me, but maybe I can get a benefit riding on your coattails. That's the spirit of what the people are doing right here. Pray for thy servants unto the Eternal thy God that we die not. For we have added unto all our sins this evil to ask us a king. So they acknowledged what Samuel was harping on time after time after time. And here they acknowledged their sin and asking for a king. And Samuel said unto the people, fear not, for you have done all this wickedness. Oh yeah, you're guilty. You have showed utter disrespect for your God. Yet turn not aside from following the Eternal, but serve the Eternal with all your heart. What is he admonishing them doing? He's not just my God. Make him your God, because he is, and he's promised. You are his chosen people. You can take advantage of that. You don't need another human being to be an intercessor all the time, like Samuel. They had access to him. If they would individually show respect for God by following the commandments, they could have God close to them, fighting their battles for them. And that's what Samuel is admonishing them to do. Don't let God be a stranger to you. In spite of your wickedness, in spite of your sins, he loves you, and he has promised to help you. Turn not aside from following the eternal, meaning keep the commandments. Serve the eternal with all your heart, not just out of physical obligation. Come to value this God, respect him. Come to agree with him that his laws are good. He's worthy to receive your praise and your honor. He's not just a powerful being that holds your life in his hands. That is true. He's also a being that was worthy to be loved and respected and honored. That's what it means to love him with all your heart. Turn you not aside, for then would you go after vain things. Because if you will not come to love God with all your heart, it's just a matter of time before you're going to turn away and embrace all of this nonsense in the pagan world. For then should you go after vain things which cannot profit nor deliver, for they are vain. They are empty and they are worthless. And yet they absolutely consume us through our lust and our covetousness. Verse 22, for the Eternal will not forsake his people for his great name's sake, because it hath pleased the Eternal to make you his people. You know, he is faithful. And in spite of our sins and our failings, he still loves us. And it is his will and his determination that we are successful and that we receive an eternal reward in his family. He's not going to give up on us, thank God. The only question is, are we ever going to turn and embrace him the way he embraces us? Are we going to push him away because we've just got these compunctions that we have to do, even though they're against his law? That's where we have to make the choices. Verse 23, moreover, as for me, Samuel says, God forbid that I should sin against the Eternal in ceasing to pray for you, which I'm sure it was a very strong temptation for Samuel to say, just like Moses did. Remember, he was so exasperated with the Israelites. Every time they murmured against God, and every time, you know, they had their next provocation, Samuel recognizes that very bent in his own carnal nature to lash out at the people for their unfaithfulness. But he says, God forbid that I should sin against the Eternal in ceasing to pray for you, that I should turn my back or reject you. God isn't rejecting you. God forbid that I reject you. But I will teach you the good and the right way. Verse 24, only fear the Eternal. Come to fear him and serve him in truth with all your heart. Let it be sincere. Let it be real. Let it not just be lip service, a platitude. Let it be down deep inside the very marrow of your bones. For consider how great things he hath done for you, which is why Samuel recited that condensed history. Verse 25, but if you shall do wickedly, not meaning just if you make a mistake, but if in mind and in heart you turn to justify sin, because you've decided you know better and that God should accept you and what you choose to do and how you choose to worship him. If you turn with that bent, if you still do wickedly, if you persist in pursuing a way of wickedness, you shall be consumed, both you and your king. Hearkening all the way back to verse 14, where he says, if you are faithful, you're going to get leadership that's faithful. If you turn away, then you're all going to be cursed. If you shall still do wickedly, you shall be consumed, both you and your king. So there was a very strong warning. Couldn't make it any more simple and straightforward for their understanding. And of course, as you know, it's going to fall on deaf ears as we see the future as we go forward. That brings us to the end of chapter 12. Next time, we'll carry on into chapter 13, where sadly we're going to see a change in behavior of King Saul.
The Church of God the Eternal has just presented the 11th message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled A Survey of the Books of Samuel, given in Eugene, Oregon, July 26th, 2025.